This breaking news from Wall Street Journal. Eurozone finance ministers agree in principle to grant three-year bailout to Greece. Your quick response. You have 10 seconds.
Okay. As I was saying, there is a turning of the public feeling right now that they realize that the Eurozone is not compatible with social justice. So there are more and more voices that try to envision a future outside the Eurozone.
I want to thank you for being with us. Theodoros Kariotis, sociologist, activist, has been participating in grassroots movements protesting austerity in Greece, speaking to us from Thessaloniki. This is Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Up next is the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. Hosted by Colorado-based Yonder Mountain String Band, this year's festival includes bands such as Grinsky's Bluegrass, The Infamous String Dusters, Keller Williams' Grateful Grass, Sook Twins, and more. There will also be a late-night stage, an early-morning Cascadia stage, and daytime movies and seminars. Again, that's the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. More information about the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 17th Annual Pickathon, July 31st through August 2nd. Pickathon is 3 days and 7 stages of performances by a variety of bands such as Tune Yards, Shabazz Palaces, Ty Segall, Leon Bridges, Freakwater, and dozens more. Pickathon takes place at Pendarvis Farm in Happy Valley and features weekend or single-day tickets, as well as wooded camping, food trucks, and local beverages. A full list of artists, stage schedule, ticket prices, and transportation options can be found at kboo.fm/pickathon2015.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, James Holmes, accused of killing 12 people at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado in 2012, has been found guilty of murder.
The Portland City Council approved a plan yesterday to disconnect the reservoirs on Mount Tabor without demolishing them.
And we'll take an in-depth look at recent criticisms of Portland's Police and Community Relations Committee.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 16th, 2015. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. An anti-police brutality activist has mysteriously died in police custody 3 days after police arrested her following a routine traffic stop on Monday. Sandra Bland was a 28-year-old activist from Illinois who was in Texas to start a new job at Prairie View A&M University, her alma mater in Texas. Waller County Police says they pulled her over for improperly signaling a lane change. She was then detained and charged with assault on a public servant for being, quote, combative on the side of the road. She was unarmed. There is no evidence that Bland assaulted an officer, and a video taken by a bystander shows police on top of her, tackling her to the ground. In the video, Bland can be heard to say, quote, "You just slammed my head into the ground. I can't even hear." That was audio from a video of Sandra Bland's arrest in Texas. In that segment, she said to the person taking the video, "Thank you for recording, thank you." Then to the officer, "You pulled me over for a traffic signal, then slammed me to the ground and everything." 3 days after her arrest this Monday, Sandra Bland was found dead in a Texas jail cell. After her arrest, Bland made numerous phone calls to the media and to the anti-police brutality organization that she runs. In the death of Sandra Bland, police claimed that the cause of death was self-inflicted asphyxiation, or in other words, that Bland hung herself. Her family and organization claim that her communications did not indicate any sort of suicidal intent. They point out that she had just gotten a new job and was not depressed or mentally ill, and that the police account issued by Waller County Sheriff Glenn Smith made no sense. Sheriff Smith claimed he would make efforts to prevent such events in the future. However, suspicion of a murder by police lingers among those who communicated closely with Brand, all the more because she was a well-known activist against police brutality. Activists say the death of Sandra Bland is reminiscent of killings of civil rights activists in the 1960s at the hands of police, when police would arrest people for traffic violations, then murder them in police custody. At the time, such murders had a chilling effect on activism for civil rights in the American South.
Yesterday, the Portland City Council approved a plan to allow the Mount Tabor reservoirs to remain uncovered as part of an agreement with the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association reached after 2 months of negotiations. However, the reservoirs will still be disconnected from Portland's water supply in accordance with federal regulations. The council approved $4 million to disconnect and improve the reservoirs, which had been slated for full demolition. Commissioner Steve Novick was the lone vote against the plan, saying that new money should not be allocated outside of the normal budgeting process. However, the plan was met with approval by many neighborhood activists and stakeholders who had balked at the idea of losing the picturesque reservoirs that define Mount Tabor.
The Friends of Mount Tabor Park Board is in full support of the joint resolution, and I've just seen these. Obviously, we've all just seen the amendments today, this morning. And one thing I do want to speak to on that is that Amendment 6, in my view, as you said, Commissioner Fish, how important the whole reporting, this accountability reporting, the transparency of what's going on. My experience working with the other bureaus is that that really needs to be a joint report issued by the parties. And to what, you know, I can't recraft the language right now, but it doesn't make sense to me. It's just sort of Water Bureau gives a report and then it's sort of up to the other parties to comment on it. It really should be a joint report. And if they have disagreements, they can include that in that joint report. And that way everybody's having a voice and hopefully there's, you know, things are going, as David Chaff said, swimmingly, or maybe you said that.
Okay, Tom Curler. Mount Tabor resident, and I'm supporter of the resolution as it is in front of you. Appreciate the efforts that have gone into it. Appreciate the agreements that have been reached by the two parties. So I'm very hesitant to want to put or support new amendments. Certainly do not support the Cub amendment. This resolution absolutely recognizes the importance of these reservoirs to our complete water system and the future use.
That was Mary Kennick, the co-chair of the Friends of Mount Tabor Park Board, and neighborhood resident Tom Curler, who pointed out that many proponents of the plan hope to reconnect the reservoirs to the city water supply in the future. Some groups, such as the Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, have protested the allocation of money for keeping the unconnected reservoirs intact, citing city documents which say it is likely that the city will request funds from the Water Bureau as part of the $4 million. CUB urged the council to specify in the plan that the reservoirs would no longer be an integral part of the city's water supply, but this language was not included after neighborhood activists protested. Had the language been included, the deal could be negated due to a Multnomah County court ruling last year, under which water and sewer funds cannot be spent on projects not reasonably related to providing water and sewer services.
The Oregon Department of Forestry released a report that cited more than 4 billion board feet, or timber, was harvested in Oregon last year. This is almost a 2% decrease from 2013. Oregon has over 30 million acres of forest land that are being harvested for timber every year. Several factors are set to affect the timber industry next year, including wildfires, new developments, exporting, and new management of the forests.
A fire in Portland's Forest Park yesterday is believed to have been intentionally set, according to fire investigators. The fire on the Upper McClay Trail near Pittock Mansion burned a 50 by 100-foot area over the course of the morning. Local fire officials are still investigating how the fire got started, but believe it may have been arson. Another fire in Beaverton yesterday was found to have started by a discarded cigarette butt. That fire was set near a parking lot and burned a number of landscape trees and three cars.
A damaged icebreaker ship essential to Shell Oil Company's controversial plans to drill in the Arctic this summer is heading to Portland's Vigor Industrial Shipyard for repairs. Shell says the vessel was damaged on its way from Alaska's port of Dutch Harbor to the drill site in the Chukchi Sea, about 70 miles off the coast of Alaska. Shell plans to drill two exploratory oil wells in the area this summer. Shell spokesman Curtis Smith said the damage to the vessel shouldn't delay the drilling, but opponents say the incident is a red flag for the whole operation. A spokesperson for Greenpeace spoke this morning about the issue on KBOO's Air Cascadia.
Yeah, well, you know, I think they wanted to make sure to do some patching up in Dutch Harbor before they brought it down to Oregon for a more thorough repair. And I actually don't know the ins and outs in terms of what the structural repair will actually look like and what it involves, but obviously they would want to restore it to its the structural integrity that it needs to do its job. But I think the bigger issue here is, you know, that Shell has a track record of cutting corners and of acting recklessly in an area that is so fragile with such extreme weather conditions. And so, you know, this is just one more example of where we're not exactly sure what happened. We do know that they ran over a shallow area that using, you know, kind of like old charted information. When they could have gone to an area that was much better mapped. You know, I don't know kind of what is the current best practices in terms of use of various technology like sonar on ships like this. But I do know that, you know, there was a known safer, deeper route that was slightly longer that the ship should have taken to avoid it, and they didn't. And so it's just kind of another example of, you know, the company and the folks that it's contracting with cutting corners and not taking safety as seriously as they should.
That was a representative of Greenpeace speaking this morning on KBOO about the plan to bring a damaged icebreaker ship to Portland Harbor for repairs. Activists are planning to try to block the ship, as was done in Seattle with a kayak brigade.
The Oregon Court of Appeals has upheld a $25 million punitive damages award to the estate of Michelle Schwartz, who died of lung cancer in 1999. Tobacco giant Philip Morris USA had originally been ordered to pay $150 million in 2002, but the Oregon Supreme Court found that the jury had not been properly instructed as to punitive damages, so a new trial was ordered. The $25 million was awarded following that trial, which was held in 2012. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Chuck Tauman, attorney for the Schwartz estate, to find out more.
Talk to me about how you first got involved with this case.
We had the first case, which was known as the Williams case, Williams versus Philip Morris, that went to trial 3 years earlier than the Schwartz case. Went to trial in 1999, and we got a very successful results, much to the surprise of Philip Morris, I'm sure, and to others, because it is, as I said, it was the first time that there was a significant verdict like this against any tobacco company. And I screened quite a few cases, probably 300 or 400 cases, before we settled on the second case, the Schwartz case, and that has an equally long and tortuous history. Began in 1999, which was the date of the first trial, but that's also the year that that Michelle Schwartz died of lung cancer, and her husband, who was a physician in Salem, came to me and wanted to seek accountability from Philip Morris. This time it was because of his wife smoking what at that time was called light cigarettes, which were marketed by Philip Morris as a cigarette that was not as dangerous, was safer, was less risk than regular cigarettes, and really as an alternative to quitting. And we decided that we would take the case. So this was in late 1999 that this happened.
What about this case stood out enough to make you say, this is the one?
Well, there were a variety of things about this case in particular, but the main thing was the use of light cigarettes.
How much has Philip Morris paid?
Well, they haven't paid anything on Schwarz. And they don't legally, they don't have to, as long as you're appealing and contesting the case, you're not required to pay, although interestingly enough and sadly enough, the part of the verdict that was awarded to the Schwarz family, which was a relatively modest amount, $168,000, is not being contested, and there's no legal basis to contest it, and yet Philip Morris has still refused to pay that amount.
Are you seeing a measurable contrast between awards by juries as compared to awards by judges?
Well, these cases are generally tried to juries, so the initial decision are all jury decisions. And then under our system, which was set up by the U.S. Supreme Court, at least with regard to punitive damages, which are damages that are awarded against the defendant to punish them and to deter them from particularly egregious conduct. So it's not related to the plaintiff or the person who died in these two cases. It's related to the conduct of the defendant.
I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Officials in Washington State are trying to determine the cause of death for more than 80 giant sturgeon in the Columbia River. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has reported that most of the dead fish are between 5 and 8 feet long. They were found dead along the stretch of river between Hanford, Washington, and Boardman, Oregon. One of the theories currently being considered by state scientists are that maybe the sturgeon are eating diseased salmon. Another theory is that the fish are dying from stress due to the record high water temperature in the Columbia River, which has also caused numerous salmon deaths. No research has been done into any possible connection with the routine radiation release associated with the refueling of the Columbia Generating Station, the state's only nuclear power plant. The power plant remains offline after more than a month, with nuclear regulatory engineers saying that it needs to clear several more hurdles before being brought back online.
The Washington State Liquor Control Board announced today that it has completed its first round of compliance checks of retail marijuana stores. Enforcement officers for the board worked with underage investigative aides to check whether any of the marijuana businesses would sell to minors. Altogether, 19 outlets failed the check out of all 157 outlets in Washington that are currently licensed and reporting marijuana sales. Businesses cited for sale to a minor face a 10-day suspension or a $2,500 fine for a first offense. A second violation within 3 years requires a 30-day suspension with no option of a fine. Any marijuana business cited 3 times in a 3-year period faces cancellation of its license.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth, where we'll take a look at recent criticisms of Portland's Police and Community Relations Committee. Following that is Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring conversations about organizing in the Black and African communities in the Portland area. Tomorrow's weather will be much like today, with early clouds followed by sunny skies all day, a high of 87 and a low of 60. Today in history, in 1809, the city of La Paz, Bolivia, declared independence from the Spanish crown, effectively becoming the first independent government in Spanish America. And in 1979, Iraqi President Ahmad Hassan al-Bakr resigned from office and was replaced by Saddam Hussein, who went on to rule catastrophically for 24 years. The quote of the day is from suffragist, journalist, and early civil rights activist Ida B. Wells, born on this day in 1862. The people must know before they can act, and there is no educator to compare to the press.
It's 5:19, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Republican politicos say that taking unlimited sums of campaign cash from corporations and billionaires is the American way, claiming that money is, quote, free speech. Democrats disagree, but say they can't unilaterally disarm, so they join the ever-escalating arms race for fat cat money. Is politics of, by, and for moneyed interests the only way? Not for a candidate of real substance, offering ideas that actually appeal to workaday people, getting them excited enough to become involved in the grassroots work of democracy, including putting in small bits of their own money. That's populist poppycock, squawk the political pros, impossible in the real world. Well, welcome to Bernie's world. Bernie Sanders, the unabashedly progressive senator from Vermont, is running an all-out people's campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination. He's proposing a bold agenda for change, calling it a revolution, quote, to rebuild our middle class, reclaim our democracy, and save our planet. To the shock of the political know-it-alls who had dismissed him as a non-contender, Sanders is catching on big time. With straight talk and rejection of politics as usual, he's drawing huge crowds, generating a groundswell of enthusiasm that other candidates can only dream about, and moving up in the polls as more people learn about him. Even more shocking to the cognoscenti, Bernie is raising serious money for his campaign, more than $15 million in only 3 months. More impressive than the amount, Sanders notes that, quote, we did it the right way. No billionaires, super PACs, or dark money. Instead, more than 99% of his funding is coming from people giving under $250. Indeed, the average donation is just $33. This is Jim Hightower saying, for information on this uncorporatized presidential campaign, go to BernieSanders.com. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
James Holmes, the man on trial in Colorado for a massacre at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, has been found guilty of murder. A jury this afternoon delivered its verdict earlier this afternoon after deliberating for 2 days. Holmes was accused of killing 12 people and wounding another 70 on July 20, 2012. Jury selection for the trial began back in April of this year. Holmes faced 165 separate charges, 2 first-degree murder charges for each of those who died, 2 first-degree attempted murder charges for each victim who was wounded, plus a charge for possessing an explosive device. The jury rejected Holmes' insanity defense. Psychiatrists working for the defense had testified that he was insane at the time of the shooting, but 2 court-ordered evaluations determined that Holmes was sane. The trial now goes to the penalty phase, in which prosecutors will try to convince the jury to impose the death penalty. That process could take another month.
Retired Brigadier General Michael Flynn, the former chief of the Defense Intelligence Agency, is criticizing the Obama administration's use of drone warfare. Flynn told an interview for an upcoming program on Al Jazeera that, quote, when you drop a bomb from a drone, you are going to cause more damage than you are going to cause good. The U.S. government has stated that its drone program causes civilian casualties in the single digits each year since it began. But independent sources, including local witnesses, government and non-governmental organizations, put the toll much higher. The Bureau of Investigative Journalists estimates a total death toll of 1,128 civilians, 225 of whom were children. These numbers were cited in a recent New York Times piece by Pratap Chatterjee, the executive director of CorpWatch, in which he also detailed the toll that drone warfare is taking on our own soldiers. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke to Chatterjee for more this afternoon.
You recently published an article that calls for a forum akin to the Winter Soldier efforts in order to address the damaging psychological impact associated with unmanned aerial vehicle systems. Can you talk about how alike and how different the forms of post-traumatic stress disorder are for the folks from the Vietnam era as compared to today's drone pilot?
Drone operators are experiencing about a 50% higher rate of PTSD than regular pilots. And there are a variety of reasons for that, one of which is stress, because the drone pilots work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and that has made them incredibly stressed. Now, in addition to that, there is the issue of what they're doing. And so a lot of drone pilots watch people going about their everyday business, and eventually they are asked to press a button and eliminate them. And if, for example, they observe people who they think should not be killed, it becomes pretty stressful, especially since they can see the aftermath of that. So unlike a regular pilot, drops a bomb and then flies away, a drone pilot actually gets to sit around and watch what happens afterwards. So they're more than aware of the fact that they occasionally make mistakes, maybe often make mistakes, and they kill women and children, and people who they've come to, whose lives they've come to know and understand over the months of watching them.
When folks are starting to give signs that they're suffering from the work that they do, what policies are in place to address their needs?
Oh, they have lots of policies in place. One is they're providing psychologists, or what they call human performance teams. They provide chaplains or religious services, or religious support, I guess. So they have, those are one way they're cutting back on the stress. But really, I'm not so concerned about that as I'm concerned about the impact on the victims on the other side of the world. And I think the issue is really not so much how to make it easier for them to kill, which is what the Air Force is doing, but to look at the issue that many of the pilots and drone personnel are coming forward and talking about, which is their role in killing civilians.
I've been talking with Protap Chatterjee. He is the executive director at Corp Watch. For more information, you can visit their website at corpwatch.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
The murderer of nine black worshipers in a South Carolina church appeared in court this morning to set a date for his trial. Dylan Roof did not enter a plea, and his court-appointed lawyer made no attempt to claim that he was mentally unfit to stand trial for the massacre. The judge set a trial date in July of next year and issued a gag order on documents from the case. The Associated Press announced that they plan to challenge that gag order. Unlike the bond hearing in June, the families of the victims did not give testimony at today's court hearing. The target of Roof's rampage is one of the nation's most historic African-American houses of worship. Following the massacre, a manifesto detailing Roof's racist motivations was found on a website called The Last Rhodesian, a reference to the apartheid-era name for Zimbabwe.
Communities across the country sued the Environmental Protection Agency for failing to respond to civil rights complaints filed over the past decade. The complaints alleged that states have been granting permits to energy companies that affect already overburdened, low-income communities of color. One specific complaint addresses ExxonMobil's expanded refinery in Beaumont, Texas. The residents around this area already suffer from higher levels of asthma and breast cancer due to the pollutants, and Texas approved the expansion of the refinery. Marianne Engelman Latto, an Earth Justice attorney involved in the lawsuit, states that the racial composition of neighborhoods is a critical factor in the exposure of toxic contamination. The lawsuit claims the states have been disproportionately putting in more facilities in these communities before the old ones have even been cleaned up. The lawsuit calls on the EPA to fulfill Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and investigate the complaints of discrimination.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, is conducting a system-wide day of action at United Airlines as the union pushes for a fair labor contract. Flight attendants will picket at airports serving United Airlines. The union wants the flying public to know that United is making record profits, and its 2015 income is expected to be five times higher than in 2013 due to a still incomplete merger. Cynthia Iverson is an Association of Flight Attendants spokesperson in Guam, where the picketing will begin Thursday. She says modern flight attendants have serious responsibilities and they deserve to get a fair contract from United.
We're highly trained, highly skilled, and highly experienced employees, and we believe that we are worthy of a fine contract, not just a contract, but an industry-leading contract. If United wants to recognize itself as an industry-leading airline, it must also come with an industry-leading contract for its employees.
Dante Harris is president of AFA-CWA Council 12 in Los Angeles. He says workers have tried for 2 years to reach a new labor contract with the merged United Airlines.
It's been too long that United has had to wait to finish this merger and negotiate a contract for flight attendants. And now they're reporting record profits, but not fairly negotiating with the flight attendants. And flight attendants are out picketing around the world, and we won't stop until we get a contract that we can ratify.
The flight attendants union says United's projected profits for 2015 through 2017 are $5 billion or more per year. United has $7 billion in cash reserves, according to the union, plenty of economic power to afford a decent contract for its workers. Wisconsin Citizen Action is out with a new report called Walker Care, a Bad Prescription for America. Wisconsin Citizen Action Executive Director Dr. Robert Craig wants voters to know Governor Scott Walker's record on health care reform.
His main emphasis has been to help make insurance companies more profitable and to sabotage health care reform in any way he can. He has repeatedly attempted to throw people off their health care or not cared whether they would lose affordable health care, has sided with the insurance industry repeatedly against every common sense consumer regulation. He has done everything in his power to sabotage the Affordable Care Act. When we project that to the national level, we think a Walker presidency would take health care away from millions of people, would go back to the bad old days of pre-existing condition discrimination, and probably would also not only repeal the Affordable Care Act, but attack Medicare and Medicaid as well.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com. Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled on Governor Scott Walker's alleged illegal coordination with outside special interest groups during his recall campaign in 2011. The state Supreme Court ruled that criminal investigation could not continue as the prosecution had no legal standing. If the ruling stands and is not appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, it allows unlimited and undisclosed coordination between outside spending groups and candidates. No federal law has ever allowed this amount of secretive and unlimited coordination by special interest groups with respect to elections. The four conservative judges who voted for the ruling were supported by the same outside groups involved in Governor Scott Walker's campaign. This ruling will most likely be appealed to the federal Supreme Court.
The planet reached its hottest point in 135 years, according to the 2014 State of the Climate Report released this month. Over 400 scientists from nearly 60 countries gathered data on the state of the global climate in their 25th published report. The report also stated that major greenhouse gases hit record highs this year, and several countries had their hottest year on record. The oceans also continue to warm and rise as the ice caps melt. Greg Johnson, an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, stated that even if we were to stop emitting greenhouse gases today, the seas would continue to warm for centuries and even millennia to come. Johnson compared the process of global warming to a freight train. It takes a big push to get it going and will continue to move along long after we stop pushing it.
A new report about the conflict in the Central African Republic has found that European and Chinese timber companies have fueled the conflict by funding both sides. The report by Global Witness estimated that the logging industry paid nearly $3.7 million in security and checkpoint payments to the mostly northern Muslim Seleka rebels last year. They paid roughly the same amount to the government of the Central African Republic fighting the rebels. And they also paid a smaller amount to Christian anti-Balaka militia groups. The conflict has been ongoing since late 2012 and has led to the displacement of at least 200,000 people. While casualty numbers are hard to ascertain, Amnesty International has reported numerous massacres committed by the anti-Balaka militias, and other international observers and internal witnesses have raised concerns about genocidal violence in the conflict.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org. Israel's military conduct live military training in the northern plains of the West Bank and kidnap civilians from Jerusalem and other communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded early on Wednesday several Palestinian communities in the West Bank's northern plains and handed warranties to a number of families, ordering them to halt construction of their property in preparation for their demolition. Local sources said that several military vehicles and personnel of the civil administration office run by the military in the occupied West Bank surrounded the Palestinian communities before invading them. The soldiers then handed the demolition orders, informing the residents that their structures will be demolished this coming November. Early on Wednesday, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded Palestinian communities in the northern plains and conducted live-fire military drills in the meadows and overlooking hills. Residents say that the Israeli army frequently conducts training, including explosives, in Palestinian areas, largely inhabited by Bedouins, in the northern plains, and that the drills are gradually expanding to include more areas. Israel illegally controls vast areas of the northern plains, largely after declaring them closed military zones, preventing the Palestinians from entering them, in addition to the repeated displacement of Bedouin tribes. In other news, Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn the Atturi neighborhood in Silwan town south of Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem and kidnapped four family members. The army also kidnapped two Palestinians from Bethlehem and Jenin during invasions and home searches. Also on Wednesday, a Palestinian man from the southern West Bank city of Hebron was moved to a local hospital just a few hours after his release from Israeli detention center following 18 months of imprisonment by Israel under arbitrary administrative detention orders without charges. The detainee Azam Shweki, 56 years of age, was released from the Ofer Israeli military prison on Tuesday at night and was moved to hospital in Hebron due to some complications. Moreover, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, had reported that the freed long-time hunger-striking detainee Khadr Adnan was hospitalized on Tuesday at night and Wednesday at dawn following health complications. The PPS said that Adnan complained of sharp abdominal pain and that the initial medical checkups revealed he has blocked his small intestines in addition to excess stomach acid. Adnan is receiving treatment in the Jenin Governmental Hospital in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. He was released on Sunday after a deal was struck with the Israeli army to end his 55-day hunger strike. He began in June to protest the Israeli practice of administrative detention. And that's all for today from IMEMC News. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Maui and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Nathan Behensky, Rachel Grazanik, Catherine Matichek, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our engineer is Jenka Soderberg. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting, talk radio from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Marvin and Angie from the Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, educator Itoko Garcia discusses the role of oppositional relationships in learning, the importance of grade school children in developing counter-narratives to what they are presented in school, and critical thinking to move towards social justice. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support for your community radio station. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for a live interview conducted by KBOO reporters.
Soon you'll be drenched to the bone if your time to you is worth saving. Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slower now will later be fast. The present now will later be past. Sons and daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the Free Music Archive,
an interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. Hosted by Colorado-based Yonder Mountain String Band, this year's festival includes bands such as Grinsky's Bluegrass, the infamous String Dusters, Keller Williams' Grateful Grass, Sook Twins, and more. There will also be a late-night stage, an early-morning Cascadia stage, and daytime movies and seminars. Again, that's the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. More information about the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 17th Annual Pickathon, July 31st through August 2nd. Pickathon is 3 days and 7 stages of performances by a variety of bands such as Tune Yards, Shabazz Palaces, Ty Segall, Leon Bridges, Freakwater, and dozens more. Pickathon takes place at Pendarvis Farm in Happy Valley and features weekend or single-day tickets, as well as wooded camping, food trucks, and local beverages. A full list of artists, stage schedule, ticket prices, and transportation options can be found at kboo.fm/pickathon2015.
The chair of Portland's Human Rights Commission last night proposed halting future meetings of the Community and Police Relations Committee for the next 3 months. Shabri Vickers said the CPRC meetings should be put on hold because the committee is not accomplishing what it should.
The suggestion to host a three-month